Part 1. Death from Nowhere. January 14th, 2000. Seymour Island, Antarctic Peninsula. Chapter 1. There was a curse of death about the island, a curse proven by the graves of men who set foot on the forbidding shore, never to leave. There was no beauty here, certainly nothing like the majestic ice-shrouded peaks, the glaciers that towered almost as high as the white cliffs of Dover, or the icebergs that floated serenely like crystal castles that one might expect to see on and around the great landmass of the Antarctic and its offshore islands. Seymour Island comprised the largest ice-free surface on or near the whole continent. Volcanic dust, laid down through the millennia, hastened the melting of ice, leaving dry valleys and mountains without a vestige of color, and nearly devoid of all snow. It was a singularly ugly place, inhabited only by few varieties of lichen and a rookery of Adélie penguins who found Seymour Island an ample source for the small stones they used to build their nests. The majority of the dead, buried in shallow pits pried from the rocks, came from a Norwegian Antarctic expedition after their ship was crushed in the ice in 1859. They survived two winters before their food supply ran out, finally dying off one by one from starvation. Lost for over a decade, their well-preserved bodies were not found until 1870, by the British while they were setting up a whaling station. Others died and were laid beneath the rocks of Seymour Island. Some succumbed to disease, others to accidents that occurred during the whaling season. A few lost their lives when they wandered from the station, were caught by an unexpected storm and frozen by wind chill. Surprisingly, their graves are well marked. Crews of whalers caught in the ice passed the winter until the spring melt by chiseling inscriptions on large stones, which they mounted over the burial sites. By the time the British closed the station in 1933, 60 bodies lay beneath the loathsome landscape. The restless ghosts of the explorers and sailors that roamed the forsaken ground could never have imagined that one day their resting place would be crawling with accountants, attorneys, plumbers, housewives, and retired senior citizens who showed up on luxurious pleasure ships to gawk at the inscribed stones and ogle the comical penguins that inhabited a piece of the shoreline. Perhaps, just perhaps, the island would lay its curse on these intruders, too. The impatient passengers aboard the cruise ship saw nothing ominous about Seymour Island. Safe in the comfort of their floating palace, they saw only a remote, unspoiled, and mysterious land rising from a sea as blue as an iridescent peacock feather. They felt only excitement at a new experience, especially since they were among the first wave of tourists ever to walk the shores of Seymour Island. This was the third of five scheduled stops as the ship hopscotched among the islands along the peninsula, certainly not the most attractive, but one of the more interesting according to the cruise line literature. Many had traveled Europe and the Pacific, seen the usual exotic places travelers flock to around the world. Now they wanted something more, something different. A visit to a destination few had seen before, a remote place they could set foot on and brag about to friends and neighbors afterward. As they clustered on the deck near the boarding ladder in happy anticipation of going ashore, aiming their telephoto lenses at the penguins, Maeve Fletcher walked among them, checking the bright orange insulated jackets passed out by the ship's cruise staff, along with life jackets for the short trip between the ship and shore. Energetic and in constant motion, she moved about with a concentrated briskness in a lithe body that had seen more than its fair share of vigorous exercise. She towered above the women and stood taller than most of the men. Her hair, braided in two long pigtails, was as yellow as a summery iris. She stared through eyes as blue as the deep sea, from a strong face with high cheekbones. Her lips always seemed parted in a warm smile, revealing a tiny gap in the center of her upper teeth. Tawny skin gave her a robust, outdoorsy look. Maeve was 3 years shy of 30, with a master's degree in zoology. After graduation, she took a 3-year sabbatical to gain field experience studying bird and animal life in the polar regions. After she returned to her home in Australia, she was halfway through her dissertation for a doctorate at the University of Melbourne when she was offered a temporary job as naturalist and expedition leader for passengers of Ruppert and Saunders, a cruise line based in Adelaide and specializing in adventure tours. It was an opportunity to earn enough money to finish her dissertation, so she dropped everything and set sail to the Great White Continent on board the company's ship Polar Queen. This trip, there were 91 paying passengers on board, and Maeve was one of 4 naturalists who were to conduct the excursions on shore. Because of the Penguin Rookery, the historic building still standing from the whaling operations, the cemetery, and the site of the camp where the Norwegian explorers perished, Seymour Island was considered a historical site and a fragile environment. To reduce visitor impact, the passengers were guided ashore at staggered times and in separate groups for 2-hour expeditions. They were also lectured on a code of behavior. They were not to step on lichens or moss, nor step within 5 meters of any bird or animal life. Nor could they sneak souvenirs, not so much as a small rock. Most of them were Australians, with a few New Zealanders mixed in. Maeve was scheduled to accompany the first party of 22 visitors to the island. She checked off the list of names as the excited travelers stepped down the boarding ladder to a waiting Zodiac, the versatile rubber float craft designed by Jacques Cousteau. As she was about to follow the last passenger, the ship's first officer, Trevor Haynes, stopped her on the boarding ladder. Quiet and quite handsome in the lady's eyes, he was uncomfortable mingling with the passengers and rarely made an appearance away from the bridge. "Tell your people not to be alarmed if they see the ship sailing off," he told her. She turned and looked up the steps at him. "Where will you be going?" "There is a storm brewing 100 miles out. The captain doesn't want to risk exposing the passengers to any more rough water than necessary. Nor does he want to disappoint them by cutting short the shore excursions. He intends to steam 20 kilometers up the coast and drop off another group at the seal colony, then return in time to pick you up and repeat the process. Putting twice the number ashore in half the time. That's the idea. That way we can pack up and leave and be in the relatively calm waters of the Bransfield Strait before the storm strikes here." "I wondered why you didn't drop the anchor." Maeve liked Haynes. He was the only ship's officer who wasn't continually trying to sweet-talk her into his quarters after late-night drinks. "I'd expect you in 2 hours," she said with a wave. "You have your portable communicator should you encounter a problem." She held up the small unit that was attached to her belt. "You'll be the first to know. Say hello to the penguins for me." "I shall." As the Zodiac skimmed over water that was as flat and reflective as a mirror, Maeve lectured her little band of intrepid tourists on the history behind their destination. Seymour Island was first sighted by James Clark Ross in 1842. 40 Norwegian explorers, cast away when their ship was crushed in the ice, perished here in 1859. We'll visit the site where they lived until the end and then take a short walk to the hallowed ground where they are buried. "Are those the buildings they lived in?" asked a lady who must have been pushing 80, pointing to several structures in a small bay. "No," answered Maeve. "What you see are what remains of an abandoned British whaling station. We'll visit it just before we take a short hike around that rocky point you see to the south, to the Penguin Rookery." "Does anyone live on the island?" asked the same lady. "The Argentinians have a research station on the northern tip of the island." "How far away?" Maeve smiled condescendingly. "About 30 kilometers. There's always one in every group who has the curiosity of a 4-year-old, she mused. They could see the bottom clearly now, naked rock with no growth to be seen anywhere. Their shadow followed them about 2 fathoms down as they cruised through the bay. No rollers broke on the shoreline. The sea ran smooth right up to the edge, lapping the exposed rock with the slight wash usually found around a small lake. The crewman shut off the outboard motor as the bow of the Zodiac skimmed onto the shore. The only sign of a living thing was a pure white snow petrel that glided through the sky above them like a large snowflake. Only after she had helped everyone to disembark from the Zodiac and wade ashore onto the pebbled beach in the knee-high rubber boots supplied by the ship, did Maeve turn and look at the ship as it gathered way and steamed northward. The Polar Queen was quite small by cruise ship standards. Her length was only 72 meters, with a 2,500 gross-rated tonnage. She was built in Bergen, Norway, especially to cruise polar waters. She was as ruggedly constructed as an icebreaker, a function she could perform if the occasion arose. Her superstructure and the broad horizontal stripe below her lower deck were painted glacier white. The rest of her hull was a bright yellow. She could skirt the ice floes and icebergs with the agility of a rabbit, due to her bow and stern thrusters. Her comfortable cabins were furnished in the style of a ski chalet, with picture windows facing the sea. Other amenities included a luxurious lounge and dining salon, hosted by a chef who turned out three-star culinary creations, a fitness center, and a library filled with books and information on the polar regions. The crew was well-trained and numbered 20 more than the passengers. Maeve felt a tinge of regret she couldn't quite understand as the yellow and white Polar Queen grew smaller in the distance. For a brief moment, she experienced the apprehension the lost Norwegian explorers must have felt at seeing their only means of survival disappear. She quickly shook off any feelings of uneasiness and began leading her party of babbling travelers across the gray moonscape to the cemetery. She allotted them 20 minutes to pick their way among the tombstones, shooting rolls of film of the inscriptions. Then she herded them around a vast pile of giant bleached whale bones near the old station while describing the methods the whalers used to process the whales. "After the danger and exhilaration of the chase and kill," she explained, "came the rotten job butchering the huge carcass and rendering the blubber into oil. Cutting in and trying out, as the old-timers called it. Next came the antiquated huts and rendering building. The whaling station was still maintained and monitored on an annual basis by the British, and was considered a museum of the past. Furnishings, cooking utensils in the kitchen, along with old books and worn magazines, were still there just as the whalers left them when they finally departed for home. "Please do not disturb any of the artifacts," Maeve told the group. "Under international law, nothing may be removed." She took a moment to count heads. Then she said, "Now I'll lead you into the caves dug by the whalers, where they stored the oil in huge casks before shipping it to England." From a box left at the entrance to the caves by expedition leaders from previous cruises, she passed out flashlights. "Is there anyone who suffers from claustrophobia?" One woman, who looked to be in her late 70s, raised her hand. "I'm afraid I don't want to go in there." "Anyone else?" The woman who asked all the questions nodded. "I can't stand cold, dark places." "All right," said Maeve. "The two of you wait here. I'll conduct the rest a short distance to the whale oil storage area. We won't be more than 15 minutes. She led the chattering group through a long, curving tunnel carved by the whalers to a large storage cavern stacked with huge casks that had been assembled deep inside the rock and later left behind. After they entered, she stopped and gestured at a massive rock at the entrance. "The rock you see here was cut from inside the cavern and acts as a barrier against the cold and to keep competing whalers from pilfering surplus oil that remained after the station closed down for the winter. This rock weighs as much as an armored tank, but a child can move it, providing he or she knows its secret." She paused to step inside, placed her hand on a particular place on the upper side of the rock, and easily pushed it to close the entrance. "An ingenious bit of engineering. The rock is delicately balanced on a shaft through its middle. Push in the wrong spot, and it won't budge." Everyone made jokes about the total darkness, broken only by the flashlights, as Maeve moved over to one of the great wooden casks. One had remained half full, and she held a small glass vial under a spigot and filled it with a small amount of oil. She passed the vial around, allowing the tourists to rub a few drops between their fingers. Amazingly, the cold has prevented the oil from spoiling, even after nearly 130 years. It's still as fresh as the day it came from the cauldron and was poured into the cask.
It feels as though it has extraordinary lubricating qualities, said a gray-haired man with a large red nose, common in a heavy drinker.
Don't tell the oil companies, Maeve said with a thin smile, or the whales will become extinct before next Christmas. One woman asked for the vial and sniffed it. Can it be used as cooking oil? Yes, indeed, Maeve answered. The Japanese are particularly fond of whale oil for cooking and margarine. In fact, the old whalers used to dip their biscuits in salt water and then fry them in the bubbling blubber. I tried it once and found it to have an interesting, if slightly bland, taste. Maeve was abruptly cut off by the scream of an elderly woman who frantically clutched the sides of her head. Six other people followed suit, the women crying out, the men groaning. Maeve ran from one to the other, stunned at the look of intense pain in their eyes. "What is it?" she shouted. "What's wrong? Can I help you?" Then suddenly it was her turn. A dagger-like thrust of pain plunged into her brain, and her heart began to pound erratically. Instinctively, her hands pressed her temples. She stared dazedly at the excursion members. Through the hypnotic spell of agony and terror, all their eyes seemed to be bulging from their sockets. Then she was struck by a tidal wave of dizziness, rapidly followed by great nausea. She fought an overwhelming urge to vomit before losing all balance and falling down. No one could understand what was happening. The air became heavy and hard to breathe. The beams of the flashlights took on an unearthly bluish glow. There was no vibration, no shaking of the earth, and yet dust began to swirl inside the cavern. The only sounds were the screams of the tormented. They began to sag and fall to the ground around Maeve. With horrified disbelief, she found herself immersed in disorientation, caught in the grip of a crazy nightmare where her body was turning itself inside out. One moment, people stared at death from an unknown source. Then, inexplicably, an instant later, the excruciating agony and vertigo began to ease. As quickly as it had come on, it faded and disappeared. Maeve felt exhausted to her bones. She leaned weakly against the cask of whale oil, eyes closed, vastly relieved at being free of pain. No one found the voice to speak for nearly 2 minutes. Finally, a man, who was cradling his stunned wife in his arms, looked up at Maeve.
"What in God's name was that?"
Maeve slowly shook her head.
"I don't know," she answered dully.
With great effort she made the rounds, greatly cheered at finding everyone still alive. They all appeared to be recovering with no lingering effects. Maeve was thankful that none of the more elderly had suffered permanent damage, especially heart attacks. "Please wait here and rest while I check the two ladies at the entrance of the tunnel and contact the ship." They were a good group, she thought. None questioned or blamed her for the unexplained event. They immediately began comforting each other, the younger ones helping the more elderly to restful positions. They watched as she swung open the massive door and walked through the portal until the beam of her flashlight vanished around a curve in the tunnel. As soon as Maeve reached daylight again, she couldn't help wondering if it had all been a hallucination. The sea was still calm and blue. The sun had risen a little higher in a cloudless sky. And the two ladies who had preferred to remain in the open air were lying sprawled on their stomachs, each clutching at nearby rocks as if trying to keep from being torn away by some unseen force. She bent down and tried to shake them awake, but stiffened in horror when she saw the sightless eyes and the gaping mouths. Each had lost the contents of her stomach. They were dead, their skin already turning a dark, purplish blue. Maeve ran down to the Zodiac, which was still sitting with its bow pulled onto the shoreline. The crewman who had brought them ashore was also lifeless, the same appalling expression on his face, with the same skin color. In numbed shock, Maeve lifted her portable communicator and began transmitting.
Polar Queen, this is Land Expedition 1. We have an emergency. Please answer immediately. Over. There was no reply. She tried again and again to raise the ship. Her only response was silence. It was as if Polar Queen and her crew and passengers had never existed.